Over the last few centuries on human metrics, things have actually been going very well. We've seen dramatic declines in extreme poverty rates across the world. We've seen dramatic declines in child mortality, maternal mortality, life expectancy, education. So although the world is still very, very unequal and we've got massive amounts of work to do, many of these trends have been going in the right direction. Now, on environmental metrics, it's kind of been going in the opposite direction. You know, we've got rising temperatures, we've got plastic pollution. And I think when you look at those trends, they look really, really bad. And to some extent, they are so bad. But I think on many of them, we are starting to get on a bit of a better trajectory. And we have done that because we have started to take action. I think the key is that we accelerate that action.
That is data scientist Hannah Ritchie from the University of Oxford, talking on NPR with Andrew Limburg about her new book, Not the End of the World. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled in Shepparton in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to elders, past, present and emerging. Let's listen now to that conversation between Andrew Limburg and Hannah Ritchie.
Looking good, folks. 2023 marked the hottest year on record by a lot. That's according to scientists in the EU. Sea levels are rising so fast that we might see many of California's beaches washed away by the end of the century. And to top it off, a recent study concluded something climate researchers have been saying for a bit now, that it's unlikely we'll achieve the target global warming limits as set by the Paris Agreement. Like I said, it's bleak out here. But what if it's not all bad? And what if focusing on the doom and gloom of it all actually does a disservice to the work of keeping this place livable? Hannah Ritchie's new book, Not the End of the World, is an optimist's look at sustainability. She's a data scientist at the University of Oxford and spends a lot of time thinking about what numbers tell us about the world. And she started by telling me what humans are getting right.
Over the last few centuries on human metrics, things have actually been going very well. We've seen dramatic declines in extreme poverty rates across the world. We've seen dramatic declines in child mortality, maternal mortality, life expectancy, education. So although the world is still very, very unequal and we've got massive amounts of work to do, many of these trends have been going in the right direction. Now, on environmental metrics, it's kind of been going in the opposite direction. You know, we've got rising temperatures, we've got plastic pollution. And I think when you look at those trends, they look really, really bad. And to some extent, they are so bad. But I think on many of them, we are starting to get on a bit of a better trajectory. And we have done that because we have started to take action. I think the key is that we accelerate that action.
Can you give me one example of where the line was like trending down and maybe it's now started to plateau a bit?
I think even if you take the example of climate change, now the current trajectory that we're on is not a good one. So we're headed on for a path of between 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius. Now, that's very bad and that's very far from the Paris Agreement targets that we set. But if you consider where we were thinking we were going a decade ago, it was between 3.5 to 4 degrees. So in some sense, by taking action, by putting policies in place, we have started to bend that curve. Now, we've still got a long way to go to try to get below 2 degrees. But if we can make progress over the last decade, to me, that seems like we can also bend that curve further in the next decade.
So I also think what's fun about the book is you debunk a lot of, I don't know how to put this, like things that we do to make us feel good about ourselves when it comes to climate, right? I think, you know, the bit about like buying food locally, right? You say that that doesn't really help all that much in the big picture. And I'm wondering why not.
So, yeah, I think the eating local thing is a really common misconception. I think when people think about how do I reduce the carbon footprint of my diet, they often go to, well, obviously I should eat local food. Now, that seems intuitive. And the reason is that, you know, we know that transport emits CO2. So if you drive a truck or a plane or a ship, then it's emitting CO2. So you would assume that, you know, the further food has to travel to reach you, obviously the more emissions and the higher carbon footprint. But I think what's important to note about food is that most of the emissions for food just don't come from transport. Only around 5% of food emissions actually come from the transport component. Now, what really matters is land use change and emissions on the farm. So emissions produced during the farming process. Now, what that means is that what you eat matters much, much more than how far it's traveled to reach you. And just the biggest foods with the biggest carbon footprint tend to be meat and especially beef and lamb. So I think there's often this argument of, you know, my beef is really low carbon because it's local. And if you're, you know, importing soy from South America, then it must have a higher carbon footprint. But that's incorrect, because most of the emissions come from the type of food you're eating rather than how far it's traveled to reach you.
Yeah, I want to stick on the beef bit, because I think beef shows up in a couple different chapters all over the place in the book. And I'm curious, what about beef, right, compared to, I don't know, like poultry or fish or pork, makes it so harmful?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things. I think one is, I think it's important to know about meat overall, that it provides really, really good nutrition, but it's actually quite an inefficient way of producing food or calories, right? So you feed an animal, and then most of that energy is just used keeping the animal alive, and then you might get some meat after. But like the conversion ratio there is really, really poor, and it's poorest for the biggest animals, which means that a cow is much less efficient than a chicken, for example. The other big things there is that cows tend to need a lot more land. And they also, when it comes to climate change, they emit a greenhouse gas called methane, which is actually much more stronger in the short term than carbon dioxide, which we're more familiar with. So that's often the kind of hindrance of beef, is that you have this methane emissions and it uses a lot of land.
Yeah. You know, I was reading your book over the holidays, and it got me thinking about like beef and my consumption of beef. And I was like, oh, maybe I should ease back up on this. But then like my father-in-law showed up with a big prime rib, you know, that I had to make, you know, for Christmas. And, you know, which is all to say that we love our beef here in America, right? And I don't know, what can we do to convince people to curb our beef consumption? Because I think that's a hard sell for a lot of people.
I think it is a really hard sell. And I think what's also really important, and I tried to do in the book quite deliberately, was not to give prescriptions of stuff that people should do. Like, I would never tell someone, you should be eating less meat or you should be a vegan, because I think actually people just don't respond well to that. And to some extent, I think that's what often we've gotten wrong in terms of environmental messaging, is that we try to push actions on people and they push back from it. I think what's important to note about this is it's not an all or nothing. You can massively cut your footprint by just cutting back a little. So maybe you don't need to eat beef every single day. Maybe you can have it, you know, once a week. Or even from a climate perspective, switching the type of meat you eat has a big impact. So if you switched from beef to pork or chicken, then that could also make a big difference to your footprint. So I think for many people, you know, just an all or nothing switch seems really daunting, and they couldn't do it. But I think just step by step, there is ways of getting there.
You know, while reading the book, I did find myself flipping to the end of each chapter first, because that's where you lay out often. It's like, here's what you're worrying too much about, right? So at the end of like the ocean plastics chapter, right, you say stuff like, plastic straws, who cares, right? Plastic bags, you know, it's fine. Landfills, don't worry about it. Why do you think it's important to triage our worries about the planet?
So I think people often get really overwhelmed with the number of things that they should be doing for the planet. And I think often they get really conflicting information. So you're kind of left paralyzed of like, I'm not actually quite sure what I should do. And you often always go through life kind of feeling quite guilty that you're not doing enough. So I think it's important to highlight, these are the big things in your life that will make a difference. So focus on these ones. And then if you want to do the smaller ones, that's fine. But I don't think you should stress about it. And I think what's really important is that we don't do the really small things and assume that we're having a big impact, and then we miss out the big stuff. I think we probably have like a finite resources of focus and energy we can put into actions. So if we're using that energy on the really small things that don't really matter, then we're never going to make progress on this, because we'll miss the really big stuff.
Sure. But I guess buying a canvas bag for your grocery trip is a lot easier than, I don't know, like convincing Exxon to stop drilling, right? Like, can you really blame folks for trying like the smaller stuff first?
No, like I think the small stuff is valid if you want to do it. But I think there's like a big gap between convincing Exxon not to drill for oil. Like, I mean the big behavioral changes in your life. So for example, the beef thing, like the impacts of reducing your beef consumption are way, way bigger than the plastic bag. So it's not that I'm saying, you know, you have to focus on how to like completely change the world, but it's about focusing on your individual behavior changes that make the biggest difference.
That's Hannah Ritchie. Her new book is Not the End of the World: How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet. Hannah Ritchie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now we have four 90-second segments from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As sea levels rise and storms become more extreme, a growing number of homeowners are struggling with flooding. Not just once, but time and time again.
People are just faced over and over with damaging floods and then having to put their lives back together each time.
Anna Weber is with the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council. An analysis by her group found that as of 2022, almost 45,000 U.S. properties are what the National Flood Insurance Program considers severe repetitive loss properties, which means they've experienced multiple severe floods. That's about a 20% increase from just 4 years earlier, and many of these homes are likely to flood again.
Concerningly, the number of these properties that have had mitigation actions taken to reduce their risk, for example, homes can be elevated, or maybe the residents of the home could take a buyout and move someplace safer, that number is not increasing as quickly.
Weber says instead of just reimbursing homeowners for their losses, it's important to make sure people have access to funding to make their homes more resilient, so they can break out of the repetitive cycle of flooding, rebuilding, and flooding again. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the U.S., Hispanic people are disproportionately exposed to harmful air pollution. They're more likely to work outdoors in agriculture or construction, so they may be more exposed to wildfire smoke. And in many areas, neighborhoods with large Hispanic populations are more likely to be located near highways or oil and gas plants, sources of pollution that can worsen heart and lung diseases.
When the air quality is not okay, we want to bring awareness to that so we can make positive change for our communities and for the next generations to come.
Juan Rosas is with the Hispanic Access Foundation, which recently launched El Aire Que Respiramos, or the air we breathe. It's an effort to monitor air quality in 12 cities with large Hispanic populations in California, Texas, Nevada, Idaho, and Illinois. The group will place sensors at community centers, churches, and schools to measure air pollution. The data will help people know when local air quality is bad, so they can take action to stay safe and push for change.
That is the goal. It's not just collecting the data, but it's also advocacy work, training our local communities to know that they have a voice.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. After a hurricane, flood, or wildfire, communities face a long process of rebuilding. But in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, there's a lot of debris lying around, sometimes more waste than a community would typically produce all year.
You get buildings that are destroyed, you get lots and lots of earth and trees and other debris which now need to be cleaned up and moved somewhere.
Timothy Townsend is an environmental engineer at the University of Florida. He says some of this debris can be dangerous. For example, some of the ash from last year's Maui fires has high levels of toxic arsenic, likely from volcanic soils, old building materials, and herbicides that were once commonly used on nearby farms.
All of a sudden you're faced with not only is this just normal debris that would go to a landfill, but potentially it's a hazardous waste.
As the climate changes, extreme weather disasters will likely become even more common. So Townsend says it's vital that communities plan ahead to deal with debris. For example, by having a landfill with enough space, knowing who will pick up the wreckage, and preparing to separate hazardous waste. By planning early, communities can help prevent one disaster from becoming another. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Plastic is used in many products, from containers and bags to electronics and vehicles. And it's a significant source of climate warming pollution.
Plastics production at the moment, it contributes to 4.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
Livia Cabernat of the Technical University in Munich, Germany, explains that almost all plastics are made from oil, natural gas, or coal. Extracting and transporting those fuels emits carbon pollution. Then more fossil fuels are burned to supply the heat and electricity used to refine those raw materials and manufacture the plastic products. So the entire process is very carbon intensive. Cabernat's research shows that in the past few decades, carbon pollution from making plastic has doubled because production has grown and shifted to parts of the world that burn a lot of coal for energy. So she says the industry needs to change. Making plastics from algae or plants can reduce the need for fossil fuels as raw ingredients. And switching to renewable energy can reduce carbon pollution from production facilities.
Also, for sure, we should avoid plastics whenever possible, like the single-use plastics,
to help limit how much is made in the first place. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Yes, next we have the opening few minutes of a new podcast from Climate One. It's entitled Rising Temperatures, Rising Prices, How Climate Drives Inflation.
I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
And this is Climate One. We've heard a lot in the last few years about inflation, how much of it we're seeing, who's to blame, when it might be tamed enough for interest rates to start falling again. But missing from a lot of those conversations is the role of climate disruption.
We know there are connections between extreme weather, destroyed inventory, and higher prices, but it can still be hard to get our arms around how this really plays out for companies and consumers.
Yeah, and one place it does tend to pop up is in the prices of so-called luxury foods like wine, chocolate, and coffee. And on our staff, no one knows coffee better than producer Austin Colon. Hey, Austin.
Hey, guys.
So was that an insult? Do you consider coffee a luxury?
I mean, I know it is a luxury, but I can't consider it a luxury because without coffee, I'm like an EV without a battery. I just don't go anywhere.
Oh, boy, that's vivid. Okay, fair enough. So what have you noticed about the cost of coffee recently?
Well, I live in Brooklyn, and so I have a lot of choice where I can get my coffee. About 3 years ago, I finally settled on a coffee roaster that I like to go to. And when I started going there, I was paying about $12 for a 12-ounce bag. Today, that's gone up to about $15, and it looks like the prices are going to be increased again.
Wow, 25%. Okay, that's real.
Right. And so, to better understand why that was happening, I actually had a chat with the head roaster, and I anticipated that he was going to talk about how climate is impacting the farms where the beans are grown, you know, exactly how climate is influencing the prices in the fields. That's not what he actually said.
What did he point to?
He actually pointed to the transportation. So getting the beans from the fields where they're grown to the roaster here in Brooklyn is where they've seen prices rise the most. Mm. And after our talk, it really just made me think about how difficult it is to pinpoint all of these places in these complicated supply chains where climate is actually raising our prices. Even for people who work in an affected industry, and even as we're all feeling the effects of inflation on our finances.
Right. Global systems are complicated, and yet we know climate is driving inflation in many sectors.
Remember the pandemic? How bad things were when grocery store shelves were empty, the price of flour was super high, and if you ordered something, it took forever to arrive? That's the kind of stuff we're talking about. Those are the impacts, though maybe not as dramatic and maybe not all at once.
Right, I remember TP, scarcity, etc. So we'll dig into that and more and other things later in today's episode. First, we want to explore a few more of the direct ways climate inflation might be impacting your bank account. These are costs of burning fossil fuels that are hidden, tucked into the economy. One major area is buying and insuring a home.
First Street Foundation uses climate science to model climate risk everywhere in the U.S. But as we've talked about numerous times on the show, climate science has somewhat of a communications problem.
Climate science lives in the academic journals. People don't have access to it. The people that know it, you know, oftentimes publish the work at a level that most of us can't understand if we're not climate scientists.
That's Jeremy Porter, head of climate implications research at First Street Foundation. He says his organization is really focused on quantifying and communicating climate risk. They did a bunch of surveys and focus groups that revealed two things.
People thought that climate science was something that wasn't going to affect them, and it was something that was going to happen in 2100, which, if you start to think about it, there's a good reason why people just aren't paying attention. And so what we started to do is really focus on the symptoms of climate change. Is there more water in the street that we're able to measure? Are wildfires happening more often? Can we measure that in observation? Are we seeing stronger tropical cyclones? And so we really started to focus on these actual observable metrics. And then we tied them to the individual themselves by creating the tool that we created called riskfactor.com, where people can go in, they can type in their address, and they can understand, you know, that this isn't something that's going to happen in 2100 is something that's been happening for decades now. We're tracking it over time, and we can produce some type of empirical outcome, whether it be property damages or additional depth of water at the tide station that you can look at, and you can sort of see it tracking over time, and you can see how it's going to impact your property specifically.
Yeah. So as a homeowner, give me a sense of how I might use your data to understand my own climate risk evaluation.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways you can use it. At this point, we have flood data, wildfire data, tropical cyclone wind data, which includes hurricanes, air quality and heat data. And all of those metrics are things that affect different parts of the country differently. So, you know, if you're in the Southeast, you may be particularly worried about hurricanes and flooding. If you're in the West, you may be particularly worried about wildfire. But one of the big problems that we have around all of these different perils is that there is no public source to go look at and understand how these perils mm-hmm. impact you directly. For flood, we have the FEMA maps. FEMA maps, even those, don't include heavy rainfall. They don't include small waterway flooding. They really weren't designed for property level risk assessments. They become that over time in the absence of anything there. So what we really wanted to do is build this tool where people could go on, they could understand the risk to their properties, and they could get that information in one place and in sort of an easy to understand way. So we're showing people historically what the trends look like, what the current environment impacts look like, and what it could look like into the future to sort of give people a holistic view.
I am honestly a little daunted hearing you describe that, because I'm sure that any property has some amount of risk. Obviously, it's inherent with just existing, but we're probably unaware of some of the risk we already face. Some insurance companies have stopped providing coverage in certain markets altogether based on climate risks. That leaves people at real financial risk if you can't insure your home. As you see it, what's happening in the insurance industry right now?
Yeah, you're right. And as you start to work in this space, you always wonder, how is climate going to price itself into the real estate market? I mean, the real estate market, our own properties, the homes that people buy are generally their most valuable assets. And when you think about the ways in which people think about their homes, they're really buying this home with a 30-year contract attached to how much they're going to pay in mortgage, principal, taxes, insurance, but they have some expectation around the cost of home ownership. The recent pricing of climate into the real estate market has really turned a lot of that upside down. I mean, people are all of a sudden being charged more than they thought they would be charged when they first took out their mortgage, which is changing the dynamics or the calculus around cost of home ownership. But the insurance company is really just responding to risk, and they're responding to risk in a way that they haven't in the past. Some of that's due to the fact that some areas that we built into in the past were safe, or at least perceived to be safe when we first built those areas. Now we're starting to see risk in those areas. Some of that has to do with just larger economic conditions. We saw, you know, inflation increase. We've seen damages and cost of construction from these climate events increase. And when you start to couple all that together, really is coming from a couple of different sources. Like the reinsurance market is already starting to take into account climate and starting to pass those costs on to primary insurance companies, who then are passing it on to homeowners. And, you know, ultimately, from our perspective, as we started to do this analysis around insurance, we've really focused on the fact that we've built this climate debt up for, you know, the past couple of decades. We really haven't done much in the way of addressing it in terms of pricing it into the real estate market. The insurance companies and the insurance industry are the first.
Climate One is somewhat US-centric, and so is Risk Factor, mentioned by Jeremy Porter. And you'll find a link for both of those, Climate One and Risk Factor, in the show notes. And now we have a brief comment from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The latest state of the global climate report shows a planet on the brink. Fossil fuel pollution is sending climate chaos off the charts. Sirens are blaring across all major indicators. Last year saw record heat, record sea levels, and record ocean surface temperatures. Glaciers likely lost more ice than ever before. Some records are just chart-topping, they are chart-busting. The impact of all these is stark, brutal, and accelerating with a deadly force.
This annual report shows that the climate crisis is the defining challenge that humanity faces. It is imperative that our actions today are based on the welfare of future generations rather than short-term economic interests.
Come on now, let's listen to a story from the Melbourne Age about a town just 4 kilometres from Shepparton, Maroopna. It's called Underwater and Under Pressure, the fight to fix flood insurance. And you'll find a link for that in the show notes.
There was nothing more Rick Maloney could have done when the floods hit his hometown of Maroopna, in Victoria's north, in October 2022. He had sandbagged the front perimeter of his property, erected a sheet of corrugated iron to protect the yard from harsh waves, and then sat at his dining table watching the putrid waters slowly rise around him. I had a kitchen table outside, and thought I might go put the table up on a brick just to get it out of the water, and the brick is 4 inches, Maloney says. Within an hour, I had to go put another brick under it, within another hour, another brick, and then within another hour I had to put a fourth brick under it. It had come up that quick, but there's nothing you can do. We just had to sit back and watch it all unfold. The real battle would begin months later when Maloney lodged a claim with his insurer, Amy, to repair the damage to his home. The insurance company refused his claim, alleging the damages were the result of a large gum tree in the backyard, while the grandfather of two has insisted the stumps shifted and the walls cracked after the floods. Almost 18 months after the natural disaster that wreaked havoc across Victoria and pushed up Maloney's insurance premiums by 80%, he is still fighting the insurance company. Can you imagine being one of the people in Rochester, being 80 or 90 years old, and going through all of this, he says. This has occupied quite a lot of time, just to prove what they're saying is a load of bullshit. My mental health doesn't handle it very well. Maloney is far from alone in his battle. Between February 1, 2022 and September 30, 2023, the Australian Financial Complaints Authority received more than 45,000 general insurance complaints, a 39% increase compared to the same period a year earlier. Maloney has lodged a complaint with AFCA, which preliminarily ruled in favour of the insurer because he had not provided the authority with an independent report. Maloney says he is now in the process of commissioning the report to present to AFCA. A spokesman for AAMI's owner, Suncorp, said, "This matter was previously before the Australian Financial Complaints Authority to complete a fair and independent review. While we sympathise with Mr. Maloney's situation, we stand by our expert reports that comprehensively support our decision on this claim." The 2022 East Coast flooding disaster was the second largest insured event in the world that year, and resulted in more than 240,000 claims with a total value of $6 billion. The scale of the disaster caught the industry by surprise, and the timing of the floods, on the back of the pandemic when labor and supplies were in short supply, compounded the problem. Insurers' starting position is they're looking to decline a claim, rather than looking for ways to accept it. Consumer Action Law Center Managing Lawyer Philippa Eyre. Consumer Action Law Center Managing Lawyer Philippa Eyre says it is also taking a lot longer for insurance issues to be resolved, making it more stressful for people who have lived through a natural calamity. There seems to be a cultural problem with insurers, she says. Their starting position is they're looking to decline a claim, rather than looking for ways to accept it. Under pressure. As climate change increases the severity and frequency of natural disasters, the horror floods of 2022 and the intense bushfires of 2019, dubbed once-in-a-century events, will likely become more regular occurrences. It is therefore imperative for governments, insurance companies and communities to act now to mitigate the risks, says Antonia Settle, a Mackenzie postdoctoral fellow at the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research. Insurance isn't working well in this kind of flooding disaster, and with climate change, this is a growing problem, says Settle. Before 2012, flood coverage didn't really exist as a mainstream insurance product. 10 to 12 years later, we have flood cover, but it's becoming so unaffordable and so problematic, it doesn't really work. Most of the people in Parliament are probably insured and don't realize there's an issue. Antonia Settle from the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research. The insurance industry knows it is under pressure. Consumer groups are closely monitoring the sector, which is not only squeezing households in a cost of living crisis as insurance premiums rise at double the rate of inflation, but because of the way customers are dealt with after a disaster. Politicians are also scrutinizing the industry after the Albanese government last year launched a parliamentary inquiry into the fallout of the 2022 floods, to examine insurance coverage and the underlying risks. The probe has so far received 45 submissions and held 9 public hearings. The corporate regulator has also identified insurance claims handling as a top enforcement priority for 2024. Australian Securities and Investments Commissioner Alan Kirkland fired off a missive to insurers earlier this month, warning them to lift their games. "There's been a policy vacuum because no one's known this is a problem," Settle says. "Most of the people in Parliament are probably insured and don't realise there's an issue." Financial counsellors, in the wake of disasters, report huge rates of underinsurance, but there's been no data. "It's a difficult problem to resolve, but we don't have state intervention the way other countries have, so it's left to the market." Insurers are legally required to act efficiently, honestly and fairly when handling claims, but victims of natural disasters often speak of a harrowing, fraught and drawn-out process that adds to their trauma. There is no standard definition of a storm across the industry, for example, meaning customers and the big insurers can find themselves quibbling over what constitutes a major tempest. If there was a storm after a flood event, was the damage to the home caused by the storm that has no legal definition, or the flood, which is standardized across the industry? Then there's the issue of fair wear and tear. Did the back fence collapse during the floods because it had not been appropriately maintained over the years, or was its destruction solely caused by the severe weather? One submission to the inquiry described the market as a confusopoly, with consumers facing an almost soul-crushing amount of information and choice about the insurance product. It is these often seemingly ridiculous and petty issues that lead to homeowners who have lost their houses in a natural disaster fighting insurance companies for months and sometimes years. We're experiencing more frequent and severe natural hazard events, which is making insurance costly and exposing gaps in insurer capacity to process claims, says Labor MP Daniel Molino, the chair of the parliamentary inquiry. "We expect insurers to improve their communication with consumers and do the right thing by their customers by addressing any gaps in their processes. Flood cover is just not working." ASIC examined the issues that frequently cropped up from households whose homes had been affected by natural disasters between early 2022 and late last year, and identified 5 key problems: poor communication, delays in processing claims, poor project management, poor complaints handling, poor identification of vulnerable customers, and inadequate staffing. "The evidence suggests these are long-term issues," ASIC Commissioner Kirkland says. "Insurers haven't had enough staff to deal with increasing number of claims that are going to come from severe weather events. We're already seeing more frequent severe weather events, and more of those events will be quite extreme, so insurers can't plan for the level of claims they might have expected 5 or 10 years ago. They need to be anticipating higher volume of claims and need to be rapidly scaling up." Many of the issues ASIC found are echoed in a landmark Deloitte review into the industry commissioned by the Insurance Council of Australia, which found a failure of systems, processes and resources. "The industry has already begun implementing the improvements identified in that review," a spokeswoman for the council says. The Insurance Council of Australia and its members acknowledged there were failures of systems, processes and resourcing in response to the extreme weather events that occurred during 2022, she says. "Insurers have apologised to those customers for whom claims were not handled to the standard the industry strives to achieve, and the industry working hard to better respond to future extreme weather events." In his letter to insurance companies, Kirkland wrote he was concerned insurance companies were still not adequately resourcing their dispute resolution teams. "The most critical and immediate thing insurers can do is have the staff they need to rapidly process claims and improve the way they communicate with people," he says. The parliamentary inquiry is examining all of these issues, as well as planning laws the industry says needs to change, and the affordability of insurance premiums, which are now so pricey many people are either forced to dump or underinsure their assets. Insurance premiums rose on average 16.5% in the 12 months to February, according to the most recent inflation data published on Wednesday. It is the highest annual price movement since the beginning of the monthly Consumer Price Index indicator. In its submission to the parliamentary inquiry, the Insurance Council of Australia says almost 230,000 homes, about 1.5% of all properties in the country, face a 1 in 20 chance of being hit by floods in any given year. More than half of these properties are in New South Wales, with most of the rest in Victoria and Queensland. Although a tiny proportion of houses face a high flood risk, flooding had accounted for more than half of the industry's losses in the past 5 years. "We have to figure this out as a society because flood cover is not really working," says Settle. There is a problematic level of flood risk and it's just not affordable.
Well, that's it, folks. We've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, I'd love you to share this podcast, because if you do that, maybe your friends will find out about the climate crisis. They'll understand how bad it is, how urgently we need to act. Also, I'd love to hear from you about this podcast, good or bad, don't hold back, please let me know. And you can contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Also, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so if you've got something to say about the climate crisis, contact me on that aforementioned email and I'll get back to you and we'll talk over Zoom or on the phone. Please give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. But take care and stay safe.